When you find reality is yanked violently from straight ahead to the hard insane right, you know you're off the beaten path. Defenestrate Media and The Left Show present The Sidetrack with Jason Williams.
Welcome to The Sidetrack. I'm Jason Williams. Last week, I had a chance to attend the 2019 Netroots Nation Progressive Organizing Conference, founded by Daily Coast members originally. It's grown into one of the largest, I think the largest, political organizing conferences that happens annually in the United States. And it's always been a fun experience for a lot of different reasons, but primarily, especially since the election, it's always been fun to get out to a Netroots Nation conference and be around like-minded people, come away feeling like things are a little less hopeless, get a chance to see inside some of the organizing that's going on, even receive some training on how you can play a part yourself. I noticed, though, this trend over the last couple of years of Netroots Nation conferences from the 2016 election, as the conference played out that summer, there was almost a cockiness to it. There was this surety. There was, a lot of the conference seemed built around, the Republicans nominated Donald Trump. Then, of course, that fall, we all know what happened. The year after that, I noticed that the tone, and this is just my take, not at all something that was reflected in panelists or topics of the panels, but my take personally from talking to attendees, the tone at various after parties, even some of the tone of the trainers when you would attend the training, there was this frustration in 2017, almost this anger, just progressives just pissed. And I get it. You know, we'd only seen a few months of the Trump administration at that point. Most of the people who are part of organizing and speaking at this conference are very plugged in people that had to provide some sort of content for this progressive organizing conference while knowing full well themselves what had just happened and why. And at the same time, facing a bit of pushback from within the Democratic Party in 2017. There were actually some boneheaded centrists that felt like the increased influence of progressives and progressive organizations had led somehow magically to Trump. And so 2017, the conference was angry anyway. Fast forward to 2019, and the Netroots Nation conference was hopeful, and it was still angry. Everyone was still very angry. A lot of reasons to be. This played out right as Vice President Mike Pence did his little inhumane border tour, just staring down cages full of immigrants that hadn't showered in weeks without a single very Christian-like comment for someone that paints quite a picture of himself as a Christian. These events were playing out. There were protests over the same weekend over the much-promoted ICE raids that Trump had promised, and taking place both at the White House, outside. There were several in Philly during the Netroots Nation conference, one kind of part of the conference, one not. And anyway, the tone this year was, and trust me, I'm not going to sit here and talk to you about tone through this entire episode, but it's setting the stage here. The tone of the biggest progressive organizing conference in the country that happens annually was, I wouldn't say upbeat, but this was, you could definitely see an evolution this year from the anger from the cockiness of 2016 to the what the hell just happened anger of 2017, and here in 2019, more of a hopeful. 2018 was kind of like 17. 2019, more of a hopeful, energetic approach to what needs to happen now when it comes to organizing, when it comes to progressive ideals and public policy. And Everything from the Q&A. One of the biggest reasons to attend Netroots Nation, especially in the lead up to a presidential year, and why, if you haven't ever been, 2020 might be the year to go. The forum and format of the forum when the presidential candidate showed up was really interesting and revealing too, I think, about not only what the candidates had to say from Warren to, they were all there. Well, most of them, no Biden, but what the candidates had to say was interesting in and of itself, but what the audience asked about. The forum is in a very open format, and all of the keynote forums at Netroots Nation are. And so audience members, with the only requirement of doing it in an orderly fashion rather than just standing up and shouting your questions, are free to ask anything. And it was really interesting to see what was on everyone's mind. The questions were more geared towards, they were considering that progressives, while not necessarily dedicated partisan Democrats foremost, find their home within the Democratic Party, there's a lot of loyalty there and there's a lot of concern there. And right now, even more so, I think, than before, I think there's a lack, I know I feel it, there's a lack of confidence out there amongst all of us, all progressives. There's a lack of confidence that the Democratic Party knows how to respond to this moment. There's a lack of confidence there. There's a feeling that everyone from Nancy Pelosi and definitely Chuck Schumer, but that goes without saying, to leadership in the DNC, to the electoral committees and even state parties. I think there's a lack of confidence right now that they have read things correctly. And if for those organizations within the Democratic Party that have chosen a path already heading into 2020, there's a lack of confidence that they've chosen the correct path. A lot of that, of course, centered around, you know, the topic of impeachment and Nancy Pelosi. And I still maintain, although I'm starting to suspect I'm going to be wrong, but I still maintain Pelosi is not so much opposed to impeachment as she is opposed to impeachment without getting some pressure to go there. And so we still have, well, maybe the Mueller testimony coming up. It's risky, I think. I've been saying this for years. I think it was risky for Democrats to pin all of their hopes on the Mueller report in the first place. They should have been building a narrative themselves, and they kind of just sat back and said, well, that report will just, you know, be like a bombshell. And then it was a little more fluid than that and left open to interpretation and put the responsibility squarely on Congress's shoulders. And Republicans, of course, can't handle that. They're not capable of governing in the best of times. Democrats, though, I think have left progressives questioning whether or not Democrats know how to wield what little bit of power they have right now here in the Trump era. And that was really evident at Netroots Nation, not just from, you know, other attendees I spoke with, but also from the topics of the panels. I remember in 2016, there was this panel conversation with some really cool, very smart people talking about technology and racial justice, talking about, the way the media works. I remember, and this quote that kind of hushed the audience, someone on the panel said, you know, Twitter makes money when a black person is shot by a police officer. And then Twitter, the company, doesn't really hire that many black people. And then the media is using Twitter now to both make a profit and also do their job at the same time. And the point the panelist, whose name I forget, was making is that a lot of these constructs, these racist constructs and systems that exist, are just being perpetually reinforced. And that panel stuck with me in 2016 and popped into my head here 3 years later at the Netroots Nation 2019 conference. It popped up as part of a discussion over the title of the panel was Building a Bench. And the idea behind this is that state legislatures, county and city councils, even, you know, district attorney's offices, county attorneys, obviously, commissioners, all of these down-ticket races that progressives have never really been good. The Democratic Party has, here and there, done an okay job of starting to dig down and build that bench. But progressives themselves haven't. They've been too busy. And in fairness, I don't think this was the choice of any single progressive organization, movement, or group of people or individual. I think it was just that progressives had more of an upfront fight to have right now with the most powerful that be. And that fight is still happening right now. You saw maybe over the weekend a dust up between staffers, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez staffer and an anonymous House Democratic Party staffer running the House Dems account, getting into a little Twitter kerfuffle, and really kind of an embarrassing move by whichever staffer was manning that House Dems account on Friday. It's indicative of this. And to that, let me say quickly, because this fits in with exactly what I'm trying to get at this week, but if you did follow that and you're currently trying to decide which side to sit on or choose a side, and I've seen some of my friends within the progressive movement already doing this, it's so banal in a way, these types of internal fights, because they're predictable. You could even, with enough careful attention, probably predict who's going to self-select to have this fight. And is it dumb of Pelosi to be going after Rep Omar or Ocasio-Cortez or anybody in the way she has been? Yeah, I think so. I think it is a short-sighted move on Pelosi's part, though I will maintain Pelosi never does anything by accident. So, and she very much has, as Speaker of the House, she has a job to do as well in keeping things in line. So there were some votes in which this new group of very young freshman Democrats didn't play by the rules, which is, as distasteful as it might seem, is really important, actually, for a House Speaker to have everyone. When the House Speaker says this passes, it's pretty important for everyone to listen and trust the House Speaker. And if you don't, find someone to replace the House Speaker and get support for that person to be House Speaker instead. There's a process, is what I'm getting at. So Pelosi has every right to criticize them for that, but I think she's taken a little bit too far and fed some of this herself. On the flip side of that are these new members of Congress. They're amazing, really, and they're the face of the Democratic Party here on out. It's going to take a while, but this is the future of the Democratic Party you're looking at here with a lot of these freshmen Democrats in the House. And they know what they're doing in their own way, and they know how to do it far better than Pelosi or Schumer did. Harry Reid got it a little bit, but Pelosi and Schumer don't seem to understand how to communicate certain things, how to generate excitement over certain things, what generates excitement. And could it be something as simple as an age gap? I mean, these freshman Democrats are really young. Pelosi, not. Schumer, not. yeah, maybe. It could be that simple, that's all it is. But I also think that there's a frustration inside the Democratic Party that's been there forever. Every single active progressive friend I have has been frustrated about this their entire political life. The mushiness of Democrats at times on very important issues, the inability to actually wield power even to, a tenth of what Republicans are willing to do when they have power, the inability to respond, the overwillingness to trust this other party that has clearly gone completely off the rails and is sinking into the marsh of Trumpism. Democrats out there are mostly centrists who honestly believe, Joe Biden said it himself, that once Trump is gone, everything will go back to normal. Well, kind of, and also, yuck. I mean, it kind of will go back to normal because Republicans will freed up to be more like Republicans again. But are we really going to pretend that the craziness started and ended with Donald Trump, that he wasn't a result of something? that, I think, has progressives looking at the Democratic Party and going, holy shit, guys, they're not paying attention. So that was really evident, at more so than ever before, at the 2019 conference. So using that to kind of set the stage for an argument I've actually made here, both in the shorter sidetrack segments over the last several years and now this expanded episode each week, I've made the argument that Democrats need to embrace identity politics. And I don't mean that in a savior kind of way. I'm not saying that the powers that be that are still mostly white and old and sadly male as well within the Democratic Party need to rescue everyone else by embracing identity politics. What I mean by embracing identity politics is, to be honest with you, a decent way to express it, I heard over the weekend at the conference, is just let identity politics happen. Stop moving away from it. Stop stepping away from it. There's this wrongheaded belief out there that identity politics only applies to people who aren't white, that they're the only ones that can be embracing or acting on identity politics. And the reason for that is, ironically, white supremacy. White supremacy is so pervasive in all of our institutions, even within the parties, both major parties to a large extent. It's so pervasive that even people of color don't recognize that a lot of what you're seeing around you is white identity politics enshrined as an okay way to go about things when crafting public policy or campaigning for elected office. It's not perceived as identity politics because the white way of life, white privilege, white supremacy, whatever you want to call it, is so ingrained in the system. It's literally baked into the foundation so much that white identity politics is never perceived as identity politics. It's perceived as the way things have been. It's perceived by a lot of really, really not so observant people as a better day. A lot of times when you hear someone whining about civility, if you ask them enough questions, you'll find out they're actually talking about wanting to be in an environment where white identity politics is not perceived as identity politics. That is the starting point for all discussions. And anything that challenges that then has to meet this screen of whether or not it's identity politics. And so when I say Democrats need to embrace identity politics, I do really mean that they just need to stop avoiding it. They need to stop refusing to recognize white identity politics when it happens, which, believe me, you don't have to watch very long to see it. And they need to get out of the way of the identity politics that really matter to people of color. Because as I've said in previous episodes, something I think white people, and I'm white, so I'm recognizing this is something I struggle with too, but we really suck at understanding how inseparable identity is from day-to-day life for most people of color because of their experience, because of what their day-to-day life and the things that come pop up in it. Now, concentrate that even more if someone's going to launch themselves into the world of activism or public service via elected office. It's concentrated at that point. And they'll experience that every day. For white people, we've just had this nice cushy gig, you know, and so it's hard for us to see how silly it sounds to say something like, oh, let's not delve into identity politics. Like, for most people who aren't white, all politics in some fashion is identity politics. And the Democratic Party right now is the only party that could actually embrace that. Now, they've come close before. And far too many especially in the upper echelons of the party, far too many Democrats believe they already have embraced identity politics, so it will be expressed very differently. They haven't, and they need to, and 2020 is the time. Not just because of Donald Trump, although it does help there as well, but because of what the Republican Party has put upon this country. It is an opportunity for Democrats and progressive activists pushing them, because we'll have to the whole way. It's an opportunity for Democrats as a party, as candidates, as organizations within the party and supporting the party, to actually say everything that we have been seeing from the Trump administration and the Republican Party over the last 30 years has done nothing but reinforce white supremacy and ignore the stories of a gigantic chunk of this country, whether they be immigrants or not, whether they're black, whether they're Asian. There is a large portion of this country that has been existing entirely within this white framework. And the parties haven't really in any way push back against that. Obviously, the Republican Party hasn't. They've embraced white identity politics 100%. And no, not just in 2016 and throughout the Trump administration. No, they embraced white identity politics. It would really be hard to pin it down exactly, but we know it was there in the Reagan years. We know Nixon campaigned on some things that when you see clips today, both of your eyebrows hit the roof. Nixon's every speech on crime and safety basically sounds like a Klan rally today. So this goes back a long time for the Republican Party. But the Democratic Party has been committing its own crime against fairness, I think, because and inclusion. Because I think the Democratic Party has taken some baby steps here and there and then basically broken all their fucking arms, patting themselves on the back. And that's why I say the Democratic Party has an opportunity now to actually, let me put it this way, the Democratic Party has an opportunity right now to actually realize some of its promises and potential. Things that the party has touted itself as being the champion of throughout my entire lifetime, at least. They've got an opportunity right now to actually say, okay, we really are that. And we really do stand for that. And that really is an important part of why we are Democrats. For progressives, this creates an opportunity to play even a larger role. For example, these freshman House Democrats, very young people, it creates an opportunity for them to actually, because as I said earlier, you know, yes, do these freshman Democrats have a lot to learn from Pelosi? Probably. I mean, Pelosi's not stupid. She knows how to play this game. It's probably some useful information she could pass down to the next generation of Democrats who have just been elected for the first time to office. In representing a district in Congress. Yes, Pelosi has a lot to teach them. And yes, they should maybe open themselves up a bit more to learning some of that. But does that work both ways? Absolutely. Pelosi has a lot she can learn from these freshman Democrats on how to talk about these things, how to think about a lot of these issues facing both the Democratic Party internally and the country at large in the upcoming election and beyond. I think what was really striking for me at this year's NetRoots Nation Congress or convention was this theme of all of this that sort of ran through so many panels and offsite events and discussions, even the keynote addresses, including the presidential candidates this theme that no one explicitly spelled out, but this theme of this, I hate to use a word like racial awareness, because that sounds like we've progressed further than we really have, but it was something along those lines. It was an acknowledgement across the board and in so many different ways that some change is needed. And that was coming from, you know, there was it came up at a DNC sponsored panel. So that was encouraging for me to see. That obviously has happened before and just fizzled out. But it was really encouraging to see this theme running through every discussion, from discussions about housing on certain panels to discussions about the use of technology in campaigns to discussions about student loan debt and the concentration camps and at the border. All of it had this recognition or acknowledgement of the racial element that exists for a lot of people who are experiencing these things in very different ways than white people do. And so that was really encouraging, and it gives me hope that this is actually something that maybe this time can bubble up, which, I mean, if it does, it'll be the only good thing the Republican Party ever did for this country, was creating that opening for the Democratic Party to actually grow into something that matters again outside of just the horse race every election cycle. A party that actually stands for a philosophy they're also willing to fight for. A little clip I was able to record during one of the panels at Netroots Nation. This is a woman named Helen Jim. She is a council member, first elected in 2016, the city of Philadelphia. She's on the Philadelphia City Council. Let me say that the more simple way. She was the first Asian-American woman ever elected to the Philadelphia City Council. And in her first term, she promoted successfully a pro-schools agenda that brought to an end what had basically been a decades-long takeover of the Philadelphia school system by privateers and profit-oriented, Republican-driven education policy. She also managed to get school districts to back her with an ordinance to tax soda distributors soda distributors and then redistribute those funds to pre-K education in the city. Some of it also went to a nursing uptraining program and music programs. Anyway, it was really cool to hear her talk. She established Philadelphia City's first ever legal defense fund for renters, who are renters, specifically those facing eviction. And she actually got the city to fight for, the whole city council to fight for, a fair work week law to promote more stable schedules within the city and encourage employers to expand these funky kind of part-time, kind of not positions into full-time jobs. And that actually led to, by the way, 130,000 sort of part-time jobs were actually converted to full-time job. I mean, this is a pretty big deal for a city council member in any city. But so that's a little list of what she was able to accomplish. She spoke at a couple of panels, but the panel that I was able to record a bit of, she spoke at a panel called Building the Bench. And the overall concept here was this failure of Democrats, of progressives to step into local races more often. And again, I get that. I think progressive organizations, the progressive movement at large, has always had some gigantic national front to be fighting on. And that's not a bad thing. And I'd hate to see them stop that. But this panel was about the need for progressives to get involved in state legislatures, city and county councils, commissioners' races, all of that, and whether it be getting your city to pass a progressive resolution of some kind, although I'm not really a fan of city-level resolutions, that was talked about, or getting them to end a law or ordinance that is discriminatory, that is actually hurting people in a financial way, that deals with zoning or even housing and eviction. They talked about all these things. The title again was Building the Bench, Racial Equity and Diversity at the State and Local Levels. And here is what Philadelphia City Council member Helen Jim had to say during that panel. A bit of it I was able to record here.
We're in Philadelphia, where we have 19 citywide seats. We're an unusual city in that we're one of the few cities across the nation that have city councils that also hold citywide seats. But we have like other citywide seats, mayor, city commissioner, sheriff, register of wills, and other things probably. So when I came into office, I'm an at-large city council member, so I represent the entire city of Philadelphia. I increased the number of women holding citywide seats in Philadelphia by 50%, from 2 to 3. Oh, wait, it is a little better. So this last go-around, though, in the most recent May 21st elections, we elected new women to run citywide, and now we went from 3 to 6. So, and all of them women of color. So that is, it's something where clearly, even here in this, here in our city of Philadelphia, we have a long way to go to bring women and women of color forward. I'm most interested in tapping into a little bit of Gabby's statistic that only 5% of women of color actually run for office. And, you know, to the local activists who are here in the room, I come out of movements that, as I said, often eschewed politics because it didn't feel like a place of power, because it felt like the value was in communities and organizing. And I still do believe that there's tremendous value in communities and organizing. However, if you are a really good organizer and if you have done your work to not only build movements, but leadership pipelines within your own networks, then you need to think about local office.
Just a little there again from the Building the Bench panel at Netroots Nation 19 with Philadelphia City Council member Helen Jim, first Asian American woman elected to Philadelphia City Council, talking about, and she went on, she talked about the need for people to not just be involved, but run for office at the city council level, especially women and especially people of color, the importance of diversity. And every other panel member kind of echoed this same theme that spelling out real examples of diversity making a difference, because there was something as simple as she told a story from the Philadelphia City Council of this issue that popped up in Philadelphia, and the council was trying to deal with it because their residents were coming to them saying, what? And the council didn't know what to do. The issue was that you had these two fairly large employers just inside the city limits that were near a large school that most of the community in that area, their children attended. And the two shifts at these two different places of work would end just one shift 10 minutes, one shift 15 minutes before school got out. And parents were literally, they didn't have time to get a car out of a parking stall. They didn't have time to get on a bus. They were literally running down the street to get to the school to meet their child and walk their child home, or catch a bus with their child, or go back to the car with their child. And the city council was they didn't know what to do. And a community organizer who was there just went and asked the businesses, could you guys change your shifts by 15 minutes to give them more time to get down and pick up their kids? And they said, yeah, sure. Sorry, we didn't know that we were causing that problem. And Jim said, this is why people oftentimes, especially people of color, don't. So everybody, you've heard it many times, you know, especially if you grew up in a predominantly white area like I did. You know, it doesn't matter who's in office. Republicans, Democrats, the same thing. City council doesn't listen to people. State legislature, it's all about the lobbyists. And the sad thing is, a lot of that is true, except there is a big difference between Republicans and Democrats. Sorry, Susan Sarandon, but I get it. I get that, you know, so yeah, state legislatures are a little more lobbyist inclined. City councils oftentimes not as responsive to their immediate areas and the people in them as they should be. It's all got an element of truth to it. But this was something that I'd never, ever considered in my life. And something I guarantee, if you're out there and you're white like me listening, you've never considered this in your life. But this idea expressed by Helen Jim at this panel in that little clip I recorded, you heard there, she said she would go out and talk to people who didn't run for office because they thought it was the least powerful thing they could do. They thought it was not worth their time. They thought they could make more of a difference doing anything but that. And I get it. There are a lot of issues where that's probably always going to be the case. But Jim said that part of this that is flying under the radar, there are a lot of people of color out there who honestly believe running for political office, being in a position to actually construct, influence, change public policy from city ordinances to state laws to even federal laws at the congressional level, if they rise up through those ranks, that don't see that as a worthwhile use of their time or their energy, even though they might make a great candidate, even though they have ideas that would probably improve things greatly for everyone in the city or the state or the country. She said they don't see that as a path for them for two reasons. One, they're a person of color. That running for office is still, sadly, for a lot of people of color, a new concept. You know, oh, that's allowed now? She joked at the panel. But also this, and this is even more heartbreaking, this idea that the issues that communities of color, people of color, even communities that are predominantly white but have people of color in them with their own specific concerns and issues. One thing that's the same across all those communities is that the issues, Jim said, that families of color, that communities of color are facing. She also mentioned, you know, the same thing for the LGBT community and for women in general. It's this feeling based on experience that the issues that are most important to you aren't what the city council or the state legislature, and definitely not Congress, are interested in actually doing anything about, let alone hearing from you on. And so she said that a lot of people of color just find their own way to go exact change. And that isn't a bad thing. Community organizing is a hell of a thing and has done some amazing things in communities all around the country for generations. Always. I'm not dissing it, neither was Jim, but it is sad to think that there are people out there who could really make a difference, have a huge impact on a city or a state by running for office and influencing the process around or the result of the process when it comes to public policy, really influencing that in a positive way, especially for communities of color that aren't running because they really have just their own experience has led them to believe solving those problems is not something the political institutions are actually serious about dealing with, because they haven't been. Because something like a fair work week is negotiable for some communities. The fact that, again, we all know that annoying as hell white hipster guy that will sit around and talk about both parties being the same. And I'm independent. I rarely vote because it doesn't make a difference. That is something I've always perceived as a white privilege, a luxury of white people to be that obtuse. And then listening to Jim, getting a chance to talk more after the panel, this was new to me, this concept of people actually kind of ending up in the same spot as that annoying, barely plugged in white hipster. But because they were plugged in and found that they couldn't actually get problems solved by going to the city council or working with the city council, and therefore didn't really see the purpose in running for city council. That is a reality out there, even in a city like Philadelphia that is kind of known as a, you know, at least compared to a lot of other areas in the state of Pennsylvania, pretty progressive. And yet you had these huge, huge swaths of the city that just thought the city council was for white people and white people problems. That is the reality that it's out there. And it's really obvious when you have a Trump in the White House, when you have Republicans with one or both chambers in power. It's also kind of obvious even with Democrats in the House, even when Democrats had the House and the Senate for a while there in the Obama years, it's still evident that they are more about white people problems. Some of that is the institutional racism, sure. Some of that is the fact that there are more white people in Congress than anything else. Same for the state legislatures and city councils across the country, sure. But a statistic thrown out during this panel that blows to hell any argument against the idea of the issues communities of color are facing being important to a large enough group of voters to win public office and then exact some real change in statute or city ordinance or what have you. In 2018, 6% of candidates, 6% of candidates were people of color, and they won 7% of the races. People of color, male people of color. 5% of candidates in 2018 across the country were women, people of color, and they won 6% of the races across the country in 2018. So that was another thing thrown out. So there's no argument that the issues that would cause a person to file to run for office and run for office and then talk about as a candidate, there is no argument those issues aren't popular, because when people of color run, they are winning, whether it be city council, state legislature, or even Congress. Now, not always. Every race has its weird dynamic, but when they run, they're having some pretty significant luck at getting elected. That speaks volumes to these issues that they're facing. And I think you can even extrapolate more from the very fact that this mentality that Councilmember Jim described of running for office being the least effective thing you can do to improve your community or your neighborhood or your city or your state. You can also take from that the fact that, well, they probably haven't had success at that level when they've tried. But I think even more frustrating is that they're discouraged from trying by the process. So back to the Democratic Party at large. Outside of building a bench at the city council and state legislative level, which I think is a great idea, especially focusing on getting some of these people from these communities who have felt discouraged from running to actually do so, and then watching them work their way up through, you know, the traditional routes that we've seen until they're sitting in Congress or maybe even the White House one day. Long game. Absolutely. Immediately right now, what the Democratic Party needs to do is open the doors to that. And the only way to do it is to stop pretending and talking about and acting like just talking about and acting the party of the people, but actually embracing the politics around the experience of people of color. Not only does it provide one of the most glaring contrasts you could paint in 2020 against the orange doofus whoever wins the nomination will be running about against, but it also actually would define the party in a way that they've pretended to be defined for a generation. And most importantly, behind all of this, you'd actually do some good shit. If the Democratic Party embraced identity politics to the point, or opened the doors to it at least enough, that the stories of, say, an African-American mom in one of the suburbs outside of Philadelphia That's just off the top of my head. It could be anywhere in the country. It could be any person of any race. You actually embrace their story, or at least open the doors to hearing their story as a party, as activists, as organizations around candidates and parties and issues. If those doors finally get opened, like we've pretended they have been for years, if they actually open those and embrace this and let this become part of the identity of a major political party, you're also going to start solving some of these problems that have lingered for years. So you're going to improve people's lives. You're going to paint a better future for the country in all different manners. And all you have to do as a party, as Democrats, is stop pretending to be the party that's listening to anyone out there who isn't white and hasn't enjoyed the white American experience so far, and actually start being that party. Embracing identity politics, opening the door to actually becoming this party and making some of what people of color have been trying to shout at us for decades a part of who we all are. It's impossible to fully know someone else's experience. And anytime someone tells you that they're woke on that level, just slap their face and walk away. Don't actually. I don't condone violence. Unless it's a hipster. But no, it's impossible. You can't really, truly know someone else's experience. The best you can actually do is remind yourself as an individual, as an activist, as a party, that of that fact that you can't know their experience. But the problem within the Democratic Party is that all the white folk have been pretending we do. We've been pretending we've listening, and we're still pulling all the levers, or most of them at least. So being realistic that you're not going to see a day when white people in positions of power within the Democratic Party just say, you know what, I'll step aside because there's someone with an experience out there different than mine, and it's probably their turn at the mic and the levers for a while. That ain't going to happen. I mean, it'd be cool, but it's not going to happen. Nobody gives up power once they have it. But opening the doors to this the identity of other Americans that haven't enjoyed white privilege, acknowledging that white people still have most of the power in this country, including within the Democratic Party, and do not actually know, can't know the experience of people of color. And in pretending that we do, in pretending that we have, we're actually just kind of shutting them up again. Check it out. Netroots Nation Facebook live feed all over the place. Google it. Watch some of these panels. But primarily, check out a couple that I can recommend here along the same lines of what I've been talking about here. Of course, watch the full Building the Bench panel, racial equity and diversity at the state and local level. And then check out an update 2019 panel on digital culture shift and how inclusive tech isn't. It'll change the way you think about a term that I now personally hate, smart cities. Both of them available on the Netroots Nation. And hey, folks, once again, thanks for listening to my little rant.